This is Apologetics Profile, a podcast equipping you to defend your faith. Here's your host, staff apologist Daniel Ray.
Welcome to Apologetics Profile. I'm Watchman staff apologist Daniel Ray. Nice to have you along. The next 2 weeks here on the profile are going to further explore how the naturalistic assumptions of our modern era that we discussed on the previous two episodes became codified by contemporary science. But it is going to be a more nuanced look at some of the philosophical ideas of medieval Christendom. It is the medieval era, beginning roughly in the 11th century, which gave birth to what we consider to be modern science today. Unfortunately, it isn't a nice, neat, linear history, but rather a complex, integrated cultural web of ideas, predominantly an integrated mix of Greek and Arab philosophy and Christian theology. By no means is this introduction to be considered comprehensive in its scope. Rather, it will hopefully serve to better acquaint you with the ideas and concepts we will be discussing with our guest, philosopher and author Dr. Paul Tyson, who serves as a senior research fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies in the Humanities at the University of Queensland. Paul's book, A Christian Theology of Science, Reimagining a Theological Vision of Natural Science, takes readers far beyond the apologetic culture wars of science and religion debates, and explores in rich detail the historical, philosophical, and theological complexities of why science in our time has come to take precedence over theology, and how we as Christians might begin again to cultivate a sacramental view of nature. In his book, Tyson notes that, quote, "The physical resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth as a historical fact started to noticeably shift from being a common sense public truth to being a hard to believe personal conviction," end quote. Much of the assault on the historical credibility of the resurrection, Tyson observes, came from, quote, "agnostic and atheist science advocates," end quote. As a result, Tyson observes, quote, "Western scientific knowledge increasingly became public truth at the expense of the wisdom, morality, social organization, and metaphysical meaning framework of creedal Christian theology," end quote. But science has yet to provide anything close to what has been afforded to us culturally and meaningfully from Christianity. So, a little background for our discussion for the next 2 weeks. One of the great thinkers of the early church is Augustine from the 4th century, who is primarily known for combining the philosophy of Plato with Christian theology. Briefly, Plato's philosophy included the realm of ideals. Plato believed that everything in the cosmos, from stars to seashells, had an ideal form. That is, there was a universal blueprint for everything our senses could perceive. One universal form for stars, another universal form for trees, yet another for seashells, etc. Plato also believed the highest form of knowledge, what he called the noesis, is the, quote, "essential illumination of eternal forms, such as beauty, goodness, truth, and unity," end quote, came ultimately from divine goodness and are understood by us as a kind of revelation from divine goodness itself. You can begin to see why Augustine attempted a synthesis of Platonic thought with Christian theology. There do seem to be significant parallels. As God is the creator and the one who made the world and everything in it, it is God who reveals to us through the person of his Son and the Holy Spirit what is true, good, beautiful, and unifying. For most of this summary, I am relying upon theologian John M. Frame's A History of Western Philosophy and Theology from the chapter on medieval philosophy. You can see pages 123 to 164 for more details. Centuries after Augustine, Anselm of Canterbury continued Augustine's Platonic integration with Christian theology and created a dialogue regarding the roles of faith and reason. Anselm, like Augustine, believed that faith comes before reason, quote, "I believe that I might understand," end quote, based on Augustine's, quote, "believe so that you may understand," end quote. For Augustine and Anselm, faith is a prerequisite for understanding. Peter Abelard, a contemporary of Anselm, believed, however, that one needed understanding before believing, quote, "For one cannot believe what he does not first understand," end quote. Not long after Abelard, the brilliant philosopher monk Thomas Aquinas made his contribution to the discussion with his magnum opus Summa Theologica. In this work, Aquinas makes a distinction between philosophy and sacred doctrine, scripture, not philosophy and theology proper as a discipline of study. Aquinas believed in a natural reason governed by man and his desire to know how to function in the affairs of this life, and sacred doctrine, how to attain salvation in Christ. Frame notes that Aquinas' ideas gave some intellectual autonomy to natural reason, which did not sit well with many in the church at the time. A contemporary of Aquinas, John Duns Scotus, further grants autonomy to the spheres of philosophy and theology. Scotus believed only faith could give us any real insight to what God is like. But this fundamental idea that there are different realms of knowledge, philosophy and theology, or philosophy and sacred doctrine, each with different autonomous authority, is the rift that begins to tear theology from science as we have it in the present day. Philosopher William of Ockham, born in 1280, just 6 years after the death of Aquinas, introduces nominalism into the debate. Now, this gets a little bit tricky, but as Frame puts it, nominalism is something like this. We know what individual horses are, but what is meant by horse itself? We know what individual trees are, or stars are, but what is meant by tree or star? These latter things Ockham terms universals. That is, they are simply categories known by everyone, but they do not actually exist. Ockham claims that horse, star, and tree are just names we give to physical things, nothing more. That is more or less what nominalism is, just the naming of things. Now, this all may sound quite obvious to us here in the 21st century, but it is from this medieval nominalism, of Ockham especially, that contemporary science can tell us a star is just a name we give to a huge ball of flaming gas and plasma. But that is not what a star is, only what it is made of. God is the one who created the stars. God is the one who calls them stars, kokabim in the Hebrew. God is the one who numbers them. And God is the one who calls each one of them by a name known only to Him. Aquinas claims universals are actually patterns or ideas in God's mind, and so too did Augustine and Anselm believe this. But Ockham, a Christian himself, did not agree. He did not believe we needed to have such notions of God having ideas or patterns in mind. Ockham simply postulates God just made things as they are. It was God's choice to create, not whatever God's rational thoughts might be in relation to His creation. And this is from where we get the concept of Occam's razor. It is the belief or idea that we should not introduce indemonstrable metaphysical ideas into a discussion. But of course, the problem for Ockham and his razor is as much a metaphysical idea as Aquinas or Augustine's arguing for God's rational thought process. Tyson traces this rift back through to the earliest medieval thinkers and shows that they wrestled much more deeply with these questions than most of us do today. Tyson thus exhorts us as believers to reconsider and recapture a sacramental view of nature. But we are a distracted culture, hurried, busied, and we are often uncritically imbibing the modern myth that our theology must have the seal of approval from the sciences in order to be relevant in the public square. So, recapturing a sacred view of nature, a theology of science, will require us to slow down a bit and will require a great deal more thought than simple apologetics, which merely assumes the preeminence of scientific discourse when engaging skeptical materialists of our time. Ironically, science has not the capacity to explain the most basic and important truths about our human existence. Love, truth, beauty, goodness and evil, morality, or unity itself. For the modern materialist nominalist, there exists no explanations for these things, other than they are just names for things that don't really have any objective ontological existence. If science can't explain them, they are discarded. We've simply made them up for our own comfort or benefit. The past has nothing to tell us. Our scientific and technological progress is what is most important. What is most meaningful and important to us as human beings has thus been relegated to the subjective realm of fancy, feeling, and opinion, while only the physical sciences can and should tell us what is true about the world. This is something C.S. Lewis predicted would happen in his book, The Abolition of Man. But, Tyson argues, this is all backward. Science can't use the methods and tools of science to demonstrate that science should sit in the seat of Moses. As Christians, we should thoughtfully take up our crosses and enter the foray of the public square once more, in order to thoughtfully establish a rich and robust theology of science and nature. As we began our conversation, I asked Paul to articulate his definitions of theology and science. Here is Paul Tyson.
As you'll know, having read the book, I'm not comfortable at all with any sort of solid definition of religion and science, but I do find it's not difficult to make a fairly tight definition of Christian theology, as in that what defines Christian theology compared to other theologies is Christology. So who Christ is the basic sort of doctrinal definition of Christian theology. And I just take it from the Nicene Creed that Christ was born of a virgin, crucified under Pontius Pilate, and rose from the dead on the third day and ascended into heaven. So I think if you're not prepared to accept that benchmark doctrinally, whatever it is you're talking about, it's not Christian theology. So when I think of what a Christian theology of science is, it's a perspective that's happy to start off with that basic Christological outlook, which gets you into immediate trouble with modern naturalism, which doesn't accept miracles. So we have an immediate problem there. So as regards science, this is a fascinating question. Historians of science have been very, very helpful, particularly over the last 30 years, really digging into the endless pit of the question, what is science? There's no sort of strict definition that works in all cases that's really acceptable from a historical point of view. So Feyerabend says scientific method is anything that works, and I think that's about as close as you're going to get. But I've taken in my book, as you notice, I set up this problem of the difference between and of. So whenever you talk of religion and science, or science and religion, you're sort of assuming you know what these two things are.
Right.
This is not actually a terribly smart position to take in regards to the history and philosophy of science, or the very recent concept of modern religion. It may surprise people a little bit, but there's a fabulous book by Peter Harrison, a wonderful historian, called The Territories of Science and Religion. And he points out that sort of strict separations between science and religion, and sort of defined zones that we call scientific and religious, only really solidifies in the late 19th century. So we're talking about very new categories of thought and behavior. We take them for granted in our post-19th century world, but actually, if you look at the history of these things, the idea that you can strictly separate what used to be called natural philosophy, that we now call science, from theology, is simply not how modern Western science actually arose. It arose very strongly from theological embeddings. And it only really pulls free of that in the late 19th century. And when it pulls free of that, then you sort of create these two zones called science and religion. And people doing science studies like Bruno Latour have a really fascinating time trying to point out that, you know, there's nothing terribly concrete about what this new thing science is. People in studies of religion, which is sort of a complex field, usually defined by modern naturalism as well. But what religion actually is, as a sort of generic term where you can separate different religions from one another, is again fairly pretty artificial when you sort of dig into it. So having said that, I still haven't given you my sort of opening definition of science. My basic starting definition of Christian theology is Nicene Creed Christology. And my basic starting definition of science is the sort of Royal Society of London idea of mathematico-experimental knowledge.
Okay.
And this sort of has three components to it. So it's got an empirical component. So you look at the world and you try and understand what you can see. It's got a rational component. You mathematically model what you see, looking for sort of what they started to call natural laws, universal operations in nature, and see if you can model it. And it's reductively naturalistic. So it's not looking for anything outside of natural, strictly natural causes. So it brackets out anything that has become to be called supernatural, which is another fascinating development that's quite recent, as sort of totally autonomous and distinct from the natural. This is again a new idea. So we start with my definition of Christian theology is, you know, Orthodox Christology, and my definition of science is the Royal Society, sort of empirical, rational, and reductively naturalistic.
Got it. Your book, as I was reading it, Paul, reminded me of so many different facets. You really are sort of getting behind the veil of what you call first order questions about organizing our cultural dialogue in a way that puts theology in the category of theology of science, not religion and science, or usually as you point out in the book, it's usually science and religion. This idea that you're tracing is definite. It seems definitionally rooted, Paul, that we want to define science in such a way that it is not only distinct from theology, but autonomous from theological reason. Thomas Huxley is trying to get the clergy out of science altogether. But it reminded me too of the move from astrology, pre-16th century, maybe we might call it, to astronomy, where we go from the study of the logos of stars to the nomos of stars. And it seems that there is a divide along the lines of Christian theology being a word-centered theology. We are people of the book. God left us his record in words. Our God is called the Word, the Logos. And with the kind of Royal Society quantification side of things, it seems like contemporary science is all about numerical identity and representing our knowledge of the universe as a quantifiable entity. In other words, data becomes numerically associated. Show me the numbers, show me the data, with very little emphasis or reliance upon a sort of word-based reality that Christians swam in, if you will, that they expressed their beliefs through word and through speaking. And then modern science comes along and does does a number to the word, if you will. And we sort of live in this quantified reality now where the quantification of our understanding of the universe kind of replaces an ancient Christian wisdom. Did you find, if I made any sense in that, I hope you can find something to talk on. I kind of ramble when I have these ideas. So if you want to pick up on any of those questions or any of those thoughts within what I just said, please do.
There's some great triggers there. It's fascinating. When you look at the early society, royal society, they do a lot of work on astrology. They're fascinated by witchcraft. And actually had a really interesting paper on comparing astrology in the 17th century with economics now. And they're very similar. They make predictions. and sometimes they're correct.
Wow. But most there's of a the formula?
Time, but most of the time it's a formula that's just sort of interesting for its own sake.
Right.
It's I think, a bit of an open question whether economics is better than astrology. But
Adam Smith is a book of spells, maybe?
Quite possibly. So I'm being a bit sort of funny here, but... Right. Once you've got a theory and you try and fit, you try and understand the world through the lens of your theory, you know, there's a lot of fancy mathematics that went on in astronomy, right?
Right.
and Newton wrote reams and reams of numerology.
Yeah.
He was, as John Maynard Keynes said, he wasn't the first great science, he was the last great magician.
Wow, that's good.
And so he wrote much more on astronomy, on some numerology, and on a kind of Aryan history of biblical interpretation, because he himself was an Aryan. Funny, he had a job at Trinity College. you know, the sort of fascination with a concept of, in early science, there is still this very strong medieval idea of a magical cosmos where there is a logos, there is a unifying logical order to the world, and they were just fascinated with how to make this sort of fit together.
Mm-hmm.
To me, one of the big untold stories, which are going to be the topic of my next book called The Meaning of Matter, is Gassendi, who gets rid of Aristotelian philosophy of matter and introduces ancient atomism back into the West.
Oh.
And it's after this point that we get the idea that you get very strongly with John Locke that, you know, objective reality is simply extended matter in motion. Which is very, very, very similar to Democritus' view that, you know, atom, void, and motion are the only realities.
Right.
So from that point on, you're starting to get this sort of sympathetic, logos-based, unified cosmos, which the methods of natural philosophy are trying to understand really as an act of worship. To a view that it's kind of just a random, well, it's not random, but it's a machine that doesn't have a mind to it or mm-hmm. a mind above it. Or if it does, the mind is totally autonomous. Mm. The mind of God is totally autonomous from the world that he creates, like an enormous clock, and winds up and goes back to heaven.
Mm.
So you get this very strongly two-tiered cosmos where there's a supernatural divine sort of God who intervenes occasionally with miracles in a world that is self-standing and designed to run itself, that we can master through maths and observation. And it's no longer about the world being a sacrament of divine meaning, which it always was to that point.
Right.
The world is simply an object for us to dominate. And you get this very strongly in Francis Bacon,
yes,
with his dominion theology that, he's not interested in essential meaning. He's not interested in the natural philosophers of his era, which are Aristotelian. He wants to know how he can use nature. Right? Knowledge is power. This is the point. So you get this amazing shift where theology is seen as kind of secondary to nature itself, even if with Bacon there's very strong theological drivers as to why he does that. He does that from his reading of Genesis, that God has given us dominion over the earth and we have to sort of take it back and not be sort of subject to nature, and that taking it back is an eschatological move. Yeah. And so the whole modern idea of progress is embedded in this eschatological theology at the origins of modern science with Francis Bacon. So anyone who looks at the history can see that theology and what we call science have been intimately embedded from the beginning of modern science. And it only really separates in the late 19th century with people like Thomas Huxley, who explicitly aimed to get rid of the clergy and women from natural philosophy.
Right, right. Now, Paul, you know, it's interesting. I was thinking biblically about a lot of what you say in your book is so rich with, I mean, you don't say it explicitly. In some places you do, but in other places your thoughts are stirring my ideas about some things in the Old Testament. And speaking of eschatological ideas, it's interesting that God's eschatology in Scripture is always a promise that is not predicated upon anything man can do. And I see that God, say, Sarah and Abram, God promises Abram a child, and through that child, all of the earth will be blessed. It's a child of promise, but Sarah has an idea. And hey, Abram, we can involve Hagar here, and you can go into Hagar, and you can have a child, and that will bring about God's promise. And so it seems like this sense of what you're saying here in the history of science and the crack, if you will, in the Christian, if theology is the mother of science, in a sense, that there's a crack, there's a fallen nature in the very birth of science within Christian theology, because we are, some people who ascribe to Christian theology are kind of doing an Abraham and Sarah sort of thing. I'm going to help God along in his promise to bring about the end of time with our technologies. If we can master the earth and we can do all of these things, then we are sort of helping God. And the glory of God sort of turns into a progress and development of man within the cultural fabric in which modern science is born, through well-meaning Christians, I would say, or Christians that had some strange theologies themselves. We seem to have, within the birth of modern science, it's not like it was created in a pure cultural sinless vacuum, that the men who promulgated this as natural philosophers, as men committed to Scripture, Christian scriptures, also had within them the very ideas that end up separating science from its mother. Does that make sense? Do you think there's any accuracy in there, or am I making no sense at all?
No, I think you're onto some really interesting things there, Daniel. In many areas in the Scripture, there is often a dialectic. There is often a sort of a complex balance of opposites in a way. And I think it's the case that, like, so God has given us authority over the earth, right? So that's one side of it. But the other side of it is that only God is going to redeem the world. And but this doesn't mean that we should do nothing. Okay, so you know, in some ways, you can see that the ability to understand. So there's big logos and there's little logos, okay? So big logos is God's meaning spoken to us through the cosmos. Little logos is our ability to understand that, right?
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
It's a good idea that we sort of try and expand and deepen our little logos as much as we can. And this is an amazing feature of what God has gifted humanity with, okay? So the problem is hubris. Okay, so once we've made our little logos a bit bigger, then all of a sudden we think we're God. So there's a lot going on in terms of how do Christians think about the theology of nature and our relationship to technology and power over the world. And this is where that dialectic comes into play. Okay, so like you're saying, for Abraham to go to Hagar was just a bad idea.
It really was.
Helping out God usually goes badly wrong. Certainly in the secular environmental scene, there's no God there. In most, there are Christians involved in the secular green movement, but the movement itself is very dominated by a kind of a man-centric view of the world. We made this problem. We have to fix it. And basically anything to fix it is justified because we're going to produce the end of the world and there's no world after this.
Right.
So,
right.
So it runs on a logic which sort of offends Christian eschatological sensibilities and alienates Christians from this issue very easily. And the whole kind of desire for some sort of spirituality, but a refusal to turn to God, sort of opens up Pandora's boxes in terms of paganism. So it becomes incredibly difficult for a Christian to think straight about this.
Yeah, and I think this is something that speaks to the heart of your book, that we could probably argue pretty easily that we don't have a robust theology of nature, Paul, and
that's right.
I think what I see, I love cosmology and astronomy. I'm an amateur astronomer, and I did a book on the cosmos a couple of years ago. And what I found in my research and in my talking about this, if you as an evangelical Christian have a fondness for nature, especially with the stars, that you're skirting really close to astrology and you just don't want to do that. So better not to take too much of an interest in what God has made, and best not to really be too interested in saving trees or you know, preserving your local lake, or you know, being an advocate for preserving a rare form of birds in your community or whatever. If you express a fondness for nature, I think this is kind of what the climate is now, it's just suspect that there's not a lot of evangelicals really robustly thinking theologically about creation. And I think that is a big problem. And I think your book addresses that.
The way in which being a Christian enables you to love and understand nature in a way that there's really no other way to do it like that. We can't afford to lose that.
Who was it? James Clerk Maxwell at Cambridge put Psalm 111 2 over the door. Great are the works of the Lord. They are studied by all who delight in them. And, you know, David's contemplating of the cosmos in Psalm 8. When I consider the moon and the stars, which you have created, what is man that you're mindful of him? And so a rich theology of creation should give us a rich appreciation for our own humanity within that creation. And I think we're just lacking that, because we're always, it seems, Paul, in our apologetics, in our defense of the faith, that we're always seeking at some level, either explicitly or implicitly, tacitly or otherwise, an approval from some aspect of the scientific community before we go public with our theology. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. And I know you've collaborated with Michael Ward.
Yes.
I love the way he sort of draws out C.S. Lewis's sort of use of the seven planets.
You're speaking my language. that was my master's degree. Did I tell you that?
No, that's wonderful.
Yeah, I Michael was my thesis advisor, and I actually my whole master's degree, Paul, was dedicated to understanding Lewis's idea of the heavens and how it's applicable for our time. That was my master's thesis.
Well, you've obviously read The Discarded Image then.
Oh, gosh, yes. One of my favorite Lewis books.
I would really recommend all your listeners to read The Discarded Image.
Absolutely.
By C.S. Lewis. So what Lewis points out is that the medieval cosmology is totally sacramental. Okay, so I've got a great friend in Cambridge who's a chemist, and he works in the Fitz Museum there in medieval art restoration. Spike Bucklow. So his book, The Alchemy of Paint, is an absolute ripper. Highly recommended. So there's no one who kind of knows more about medieval pigment recipes than Spike.
That's a fantastic knowledge set to have.
Yeah. But the fascinating thing is the recipes for different colors are kind of symbolic and sacramental sort of sort of processes. So
that's fascinating.
But it, as you know, like silver, like the moon is one of the seven planets,
right?
And its color in medieval cosmology, its color is silver.
Exactly.
Right? And it has certain meanings, and there's resonances between the metal silver and the moon and their significance. And you use the color silver in paints for certain reasons, right?
Wow.
So medieval art is a kind of an imaginative response to the logos speaking to the natural, speaking through the heavens and speaking in nature, so that God speaks to us from everything. So Lewis really gets how this sort of rich and magically meaning saturated view of nature was integral to medieval Christian thinking.
And it was what Lewis admired most about the medieval model was its unity and its beauty. He certainly didn't think that it was necessarily, in the scientific sense, true. But in some ways, and knowing Lewis, I read his work in English literature for my master's thesis.
Oh, wow, that's a fat book.
That is, and I have some dense notes, and I go back and I look at it. And
excellent. You must have been one of three people I know who's read
that. That's right. Michael's like, well, Daniel, you're going to have to read that book if you want to do this. And I said, sure, that's going to be a challenge. I'm in this. I'm studying with a Lewis scholar. Why wouldn't I not read this with you, Michael? Of course. And, you know, he's talking about literature in the 16th century. But one of Lewis's favorite people from that time was Edmund Spenser, who was a poet in 16th century. But it was what Lewis admired in Spenser that inspired him, I think, to write the Narnia Chronicles. And Lewis's imaginative writings, especially in Narnia, are so layered with meaning because he's emulating not only Spenser in combining various different aspects of lore and myth and medieval cosmos and the imagery of the medieval cosmos. Tolkien hated, he just said it just wouldn't do. It was a mishmash. He didn't like Narnia. He thought Lewis was just trying to throw a bunch of stuff together. But Lewis was masterful.
Tolkien's wonderful, but like he's a bit OCD about getting the light.
Well, you look at the difference between the way the two men wrote books. Lewis could just churn them out. Tolkien would spend years on three pages, you know? And
because he has to write the 2,000-year history.
He does, right? He's got to get all the language and the jots and tittles of elven language all together. But Lewis, the point of all this, and as you know, as you're expressing, I didn't know about the paint. That's fascinating. I'm going to have to get Spike's book. But that there was, Lewis was doing what Spenser was doing, and he believed what Spenser was doing was emulating the creator who layers creation with meaning. In other words, we can look at Romans 1, where we can discern God's invisible attributes through what God has made. And so it's a kind of, Lewis would call it a poema, a divine poema, speaking. The Logos creating the cosmos and everything in the cosmos is a rich metaphorical expression of God's glory. And this is just what blew my mind when I was studying Michael's book and studying Lewis at a greater depth. I was like, this man has the most fantastic layered imagination of anyone that I've ever read. And that's why I appreciated him so much. And our book, The Story of the Cosmos, came out of my master's thesis about Lewis and imagination. And it's the way I think, too. Everything has multi-layered meaning. But it seems today, Paul, in the sort of science before theology kind of world in which we live, there's no meaning. Well, the meeting is reduced to the smallest possible constituent of matter. And we are in a democratist kind of atoms in the void moment in our history, perhaps, where the ultimate meaning is a kind of quantified nothingness. And Lewis talks about this in another essay called The Empty Universe. But even in the discarded image, the concept is the same. We have emptied the universe of its layered and rich theological meaning in the modern sense. In trying to be good rationalists, empiricists, and numerologists, we've eviscerated the logos-saturated glory that permeates all of the universe, at least in our minds, would you think?
Yeah, but it's still there.
It's still there. We still have to wrestle with it. Right, exactly. We didn't do it. We didn't put it away. It's just the...
We haven't got a language for it anymore.
That's right. That's right.
So let me be a little bit dangerous here. Is that okay, Daniel?
Absolutely.
So I'm a born and bred Baptist, okay? So I totally get the evangelical world. But this is a real evangelical problem. We have lost sacramental sense.
Yes.
We are very modernist. And we approach, see, the difference between an evangelical and Richard Dawkins is not that much. Let me try and explain. So I'll sort of paint myself as a kind of a classically modernist evangelical. So we'll start that way. Okay.
All right.
But I'm a firm believer in nature and supernature. So the natural world is made by God for human use. It's self-standing. It's just stuff, and it's up to us to understand it and use it and make of it what we want, and to dominate, have dominion over the world, and to understand it, and to make all the beasts of the earth and the fish of the ocean subject to us, and to use it how we like. So if I've got that pragmatic instrumental view of what it means to have dominion over the earth, that sort of goes with the modern territory of a totally separated nature from a totally separated supernature. Now, the supernature is there. It's heaven, right?
Right.
And it's God, and there's an under level where the devil is, right? So there's a dynamic spiritual realm, but it's self-standingly discrete from the natural world. Even though there's sort of, you know, ventures into the natural from the supernatural, the two spheres are kind of self-standingly autonomous. Okay? And so there's no real sacramental meaning to nature.
That's right.
And so the difference between an evangelical and a Richard Dawkins is almost not there. The Richard Dawkins has just got rid of the supernatural that's not connected to the natural anyway, right? Mm-hmm. So there's sort of flip sides of this, the same view of a totally self-standing nature.
Well, that makes sense, Paul, because the battleground in evangelical America here in the States is kind of it's kind of set upon the idea of, okay, Dawkins and, say, Ken Ham or any creationist that you might think of, intelligent design, anybody. So you pit Dawkins' ideas. He's often quoted in apologetics when you're talking about these, quote-unquote, science and religion conversations where Dawkins, some spicy quote of Dawkins is brought in, and then the Christian tends to be speaking in the opposite tone, and sometimes that opposition to Dawkins is the same kind of militancy in some sense. And what I mean by that, and I don't mean I don't mean it in a polemically rude kind of personal way, but just in a sort of shrill battleground where you're both talking to each other through the lens of science, and the evangelical surrenders to the terms of the conversation that science comes first. So we're going to prove old Richard wrong with good science, not a sacramental view of nature, because Dawkins would just blow his nose at that. So we don't even try, Paul, to recover a sacramental voice when we're speaking of the universe or creation or something like this. But when you talk about sacraments, and I have an example of this, I was in San Francisco a couple of years ago, and I was in the Muir Woods, where there's these huge 2,000-year-old coastal redwood trees. And they have a grove of these trees called the Cathedral, where there's actually a sign that asks you to be quiet. And it's beautiful, Paul, especially when the morning fog rolls in and it's sunrise and whatever. But, you know, an evangelical would be a little uncomfortable with this because it looks like the pagans are trying to make a worship center where people are coming in and worshiping the trees. But in some sense, I think there is some truth to this sacramental view of nature. We're afraid of it. We're afraid that if we somehow anoint creation with this sacramental point of view, that we're too close to paganism or astrology or witchcraft, and it just sounds like a love, not just a love of nature because God created it, but rather it's just a love of nature for its own sake. But in some sense, in your analogy of being a total modernist, Paul, and we kind of joked about this at the beginning, it's not just economics that might be a little like astrology or witchcraft. It's science, that if we're purely modern and the universe and our earth is just here for us to use like stuff, well, there's no sacrament to the stuff I'm going to use. I can't look at nature that way. I'm only looking at nature pragmatically and utilitarian. And both Dawkins and evangelicals share that same sort of outlook on the physical world. So it's hard to even begin that conversation about nature being sacred. Do you agree?
Yes, yes. So I think you're spot on there, Daniel, that now this is going to sound a bit rude, but what evangelicals and modern atheists, scientistic atheists have in common is a lot more than what they have in different.
Mm.
And it's a basic view that nature is separated from supernature, that the Richard Dawkins doesn't need the supernature at all. He can explain everything just with nature. Mm-hmm. So he just gives it the flick. But if we have this view of nature which is kind of theologically safe for us because we're never going to worship it because we don't sort of think it's got sort of sacred and magical powers in it, right that produces Richard Dawkins, right? Mm-hmm. It's in the West, it's religion that gets rid of magic. So the view that Lewis is talking about, the high medieval sacramental view of nature, is eroded over the late Middle Ages. And by the 16th century, when you have this natura pura idea that nature doesn't need grace, that everything is has its own sort of every created thing in nature has its own ontological standing. Now I'm going to explain that word in a second. I don't know if you know Gerard Manley Hopkins' poetry.
Oh, absolutely, the Shook Foil. The grandeur of God. Yeah.
So the world is charged with the glory of God. It will fall out. I can't remember the full poem, but you know the poem I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So Hopkins is a Scotist, okay? And this is really interesting. Okay, so the 14th century is where things go adapt amazingly out of the high medieval view that Lewis so loves, and that, if you want a Catholic view, Joseph Pieper's book, Scholasticism, is just beautiful. Look at this high medieval view as well. And Chesterton writes brilliantly on this as well. So that view starts to fade from the start of the 14th century, even with the Franciscans, particularly Scotus and Ockham.
Okay.
Now, the great synthetic mind of the high medieval period is Thomas Aquinas.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a rare genius. There are four great geniuses of the Western intellectual tradition. I would put them as Plato, Aristotle, pre-Christian, and then Augustine and Aquinas as Christian. So Thomas manages to reincorporate Aristotle back into Western intellectual tradition. So the high intellectual tradition of Greco-Roman Empire dies with the Greco-Roman Empire in the 6th century as far as the West is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Keeps going all the time in Byzantium until the Turks get rid of that in the 15th century. But the Arabic world takes on a lot of the classical learning, and by far the most sophisticated and advanced city in the world in the ninth century was Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
So 700 lending libraries, gas street lights, medical technology, far in advance of anywhere else. They're amazing, and we pinched their number system, and we pinched a lot of stuff from the Arabs.
Yeah.
And it all comes back to the West via Sicily in the 12th century by Arabic and Jewish and Christian scholars working in Sicily doing translations. And Aristotle Aquinas synthesizes Aristotle back into an Augustinian metaphysical framework. Now, Augustine really has a Christian Platonist metaphysics. So Aristotle does this amazing synthesis of an underlying, a high metaphysics of an Augustinian Neoplatonist variety with a logic and a science and an ethics that appeals strongly to Aristotle. Now, there are many great geniuses like Aquinas, so you know you get them every couple thousand years.
Yeah.
People were not as good as holding the synthesis together as the master, and it crashes very quickly. It even crashes in his own lifetime. He's kind of banned for a while, and he gives up writing the Summa Theologia. But that's an old story. But
it's a good one where he says he was asked why he stopped, and he said he had an experience that made all of his work like straw to him.
That's a fascinating and complicated story.
It is. But there's no genius quite like Aquinas for combining Augustinian Platonic metaphysics with Christian theology, with Aristotle science, if you will. A fantastic synthesis. And this is the kind of synthesis that impressed Lewis too, where you can combine these different ideas and you're not, I think the thing that makes Aquinas so fascinating is he does the exact opposite of what modernity does, Paul. He doesn't silo things. He does a synthesis. He tries to do an integrated synthesis of things, of these rich traditions, instead of just siloing this or siloing that or siloing this. He brings them all together in a narrative that is quite impressive.
The problem is people don't have the same scope of mind as Thomas.
That's right.
So Neo-Thomism has been, pardon any Catholic listeners, but 19th century and 20th century Neo-Thomism, I think, was a disaster. There are many Catholics who would think it's a disaster too, particularly the sourcement movement of the 20th century. So the problem with trying to have these things in tension, trying to have a really empirically based, logical, bottom-up, natural theology, which is a synthesis of Christian doctrine and Aristotelian science, in conversation with a top-down, revealed, high Neoplatonist Christian metaphysics, is that not many people can hold all those balls in the air at once like Thomas could.
Mm-hmm.
So you get people specializing just in the brilliant sort of logic and science of Aristotle, and these people are called in the 13th century Greek necessitists. They come up with the idea that God has to be rational, and in fact, God can't do whatever he likes. He has to follow reason all the time. So, in fact, reason is God, not God. And this is what the Catholic Church got really worried about, and they banned Thomas. One of the, you know, totally orthodox kickbacks against Thomas was SCOTUS, in denying sort of Greek necessitism. He said, well, you know, something is not right because it's rational and natural. It's right because God says it's right. And if God says murder's right, that makes it right. So you can see SCOTUS is grappling with the issues of his time. And one of the other things he's really upholds is that each individual thing is unique and reveals the glory of God uniquely. And that's what the Manly Hopkins trajectory is all about.
Right.
The sort of the richness of what they call hecacity or thisness.
Christ plays in 10,000 places.
Yeah, every little tiny detail of creation is unique and self-standing. And but this kind of plays into anomalism that William of Ockham is very famous for, or infamous for, depending on which side of the fence you're on. To me, he's infamous, but we'll get there in a minute. Where there's a denial of participation. Okay, so there was a crude, in the 11th century, there was a crude medieval realism that didn't have almost any of Plato's writings. So I think they only had half of the Timaeus. So it wasn't very sophisticated. And there was this kind of idea that the ideal world of forms is full of, you know, there's a divine table. And all tables participate in the idea of the table, and they're partial expressions of the real, true table that exists in heaven. Right? Now this is something that Abelard completely destroyed with Aristotelian logic, and Abelard was the beginning of the reductive and nominalist trajectory in Western thinking.
Yeah,
and Ockham continues that tradition. He says, look, so what we call Occam's razor, which is sort of vulgarized by saying, you know, the simplest explanation is the best explanation.
Not quite what the razor was all about.
It's not what he said at all.
Right.
So Occam's razor is the principle of ontological sufficiency. So don't multiply causes beyond necessity is Occam's razor. And this means if you don't need a metaphysical explanation for something, don't use it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so you can see sort of participatory categories like in theology, the church is a participatory idea. Okay. So I'm a particular individual, but I'm a member of a body that is bigger than me, the church.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this sort of divine entity that I'm a part of, which is not physical as such, and that's what we would call ontological participation. I participate in a level of being, a body of Christ that is not simply physical, but is metaphysical.
Who is my neighbor? Maybe they are atheists, Latter-day Saints, Jehovah's Witnesses, or Muslims. What do I say to them? How can I share my faith with them? Watchman.org has a wealth of resources available to equip you to better understand your non-Christian neighbors. Be sure to check out Watchman.org for more information.